I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. We're not all economical geniuses, and we've probably made less than sterling financial choices along the way. Dr. Lori Santos is here to tell us about her research on the origins of our irrational decisions. The Yale University psychologist draws on an evolutionary cousin's propensity for theft, hoarding, and competitiveness to explain our own fiscal behavior. Yep, today we're talking monkey economics and why it means we humans might not be as unique as we once thought. Plus, Brian McTavish is here to tell us what to do with our weekend. He'll give us the details about a sketchy comedy performance, an R-rated puppet show, and what's going on at some of KC's popular weekend hotspots. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Dr. Lori Santos had designs on becoming a lawyer. Today, she studies monkeys. But the cool thing is, her work is helping human beings understand some of our best and worst tendencies, and it raises an intriguing question. Are human beings built to make the same types of errors over and over again? And if that's the case, are we doomed to the same sort of failures we saw in 2008 with the collapse of the housing market and the near collapse of the American economy? Yes, it's monkeys that are showing us the way here. Dr. Lori Santos is an associate professor of psychology at Yale. She's also the director of the Comparative Cognition Laboratory. She'll be in town next week to give us a lecture on what she learned from her study of monkeys, and she joins us this morning from Yale. And Dr. Santos, it's a pleasure. Good morning to you.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, you were going to become a lawyer. You had everything going for you, Lori, but yet you wound up studying monkeys and giving talks at TED conferences. What happened to you?
Yeah, well, I think I found psychology pretty early in life. I think the lawyer thing was pretty short-lived, although definitely making a prettier buck than I am being a monkey professor. But what happened was I just kind of got fascinated with the human mind. And I think lawyers have to worry about the human mind, too, but sort of why we make the mistakes we do was always a little bit intriguing to me, and monkeys were a cool way to test it.
How did you get hooked on psychology and monkeys? How did that happen? Because there was a little bit of serendipity involved here, wasn't there?
Yeah, so for me it was that when I was a freshman in college, I got kicked out of the typical pre-law course. And, as most freshmen are, I was kind of devastated by this, and, the person who was counseling me said, well, maybe why don't you try taking a psychology course? Lawyers need psychology. And that first freshman semester, I took Introduction to Psychology, and I was completely hooked from there on.
And where did the monkeys come from?
Well, the monkeys come from the fact that where I went to undergraduate at Harvard, and at the time there was a lab there studying primates and primate cognition. And that very first semester, I decided to try it out. And it was just incredibly fascinating. You deal with these creatures that are so much like us, but also so different. And they just seem to be this perfect window into all the things I was curious about with humans.
And they're like us how, Lori? What have you noticed over the years?
Well, they have in some ways many of the same problems. When you hang out with the field group of monkeys that I work with, it feels like you're watching a human soap opera, right? They're worried about their kids and how they're doing in life. They're worried about their relationships. They're worried about, where they're going to get resources. And in many ways, it's so much like us, yet they navigate all these problems without language, without iPhones and all the tools we have. So in so many ways, so similar, but also so different.
And you can see that as you spend time with them?
Yeah, exactly. Just watching their natural behavior, it's really hard not to read into it all of the kinds of things we care about in our own species.
There was a day when you were eating all by yourself on a beach down in Puerto Rico as you were doing some research, and a monkey came along. What happened next?
Yeah, so this is the site where I actually do some work. It's this island off the coast of Puerto Rico that's home to 1,000 monkeys. So, you have these occasions where monkeys come up to you, but, this particular day I was eating my lunch and this monkey had come along and, he was eating what he had foraged for, and we kind of sat there looking at each other, and it was just remarkable in some ways how similar we were. And I just wondered, what is he thinking? Is he worried about the same things I was worried about that afternoon? What do you think about completely different? The cool thing is we now have some tools to start asking some of these questions.
And this monkey actually sat down right next to you and just ate away just as you were eating, right?
Yeah, and I had chosen a nice spot on the beach to, you know, sit and enjoy my lunch because I thought it was beautiful. I was wondering, you know, does he think it's beautiful? Is that why he chose this? You know, he enjoying his lunch. And so.
Yeah. Along the way, you realized that the monkeys were studying you as much as you were studying them. How did you come to that realization?
I mean, one of the things that's interesting is that they are also astute observers of human behavior, and they're actually pretty curious. So you had many cases where the monkeys would actually be watching making decisions and watching you behaving out there. So, you know, we had all these cases where you start wondering, who's the scientist here and who's the researcher, who's the monkey?
How much fun is it to work with them at the end of the day, Lori?
They're really fabulous. I mean, it's one of the privileges. I mean, when I wake up in the morning and I know I get to hop off to a tropical island and not just be in its beautiful place, but watch these interesting, exquisite creatures, it's just fabulous. I mean, even my undergraduates really appreciate this as well, you know, when they realize that, you know, for their research project, they can head off to this gorgeous island and hang out with monkeys, you know. We get lots of applications, as you might imagine.
We're talking with Dr. Lori Santos from Yale about her research on monkeys and what they have to teach us about our own behavior. You know, you posed a question at the TED conference, which I thought was so interesting, and that was, how can human beings who are as smart as we are, how can we so consistently make the same errors, Lori, over and over again? And you were asking, where do our mistakes come from? What have you concluded about all that?
Well, one of the things we figured out is that it seems like at least some of our mistakes might not come from, you know, the kinds of culture we experience as humans and sort of human-specific experiences. It might be some of them come from our evolutionary history. And particularly some of them might come from the fact that over time we might have built in strategies that might be a bit more biased than we expect.
In what way?
Well, one of the ways we've been looking at has to do with the way we make decisions in particular markets. I mean, this is a topic that I'm sure has come up on your radio show before over the last few years, right? The fact that we seem to make strategically bad moves when it comes to money. You know, we invest in ways that might not be as clever as we should. You know, we hang on to our homes and markets that are failing longer than we should. It seems like we're just bad economic strategists. So we were just interested in whether these errors come from, you know, just random mistakes that people make, or these predictable things that might be inherent in our biology somehow.
And what was interesting then, and really fascinating, is that you set up your own monkey economy to sort of test some of these theories. And I was wondering, what made you think, before you describe what you did, what made you think that would work?
Well, we didn't really know. Scientists sort of jump into this stuff not necessarily knowing if things are going to work. But we thought, you know, maybe some of the strategies we have to deal with are exactly the kind of things our monkeys deal with, right? I mean, monkeys don't naturally have markets like the ones humans do, but, you know, they trade things like grooming and they have to worry about who's defending them and so on. So they have their own biological markets. We thought, well, what if we introduce a very human-like market with an economy, with symbols and tokens? Can they understand that first? And if they can, do they make the same kinds of mistakes that we do?
And you found out that, indeed, they can, right?
They can, yeah. That was one of the most remarkable things we figured out. The way we did it was to introduce monkeys to their own currency. So we gave them these little metal washers that they could actually trade with humans for food. and they picked this up remarkably quickly. You know, they're curious critters, so they, you know, immediately pick up these little tokens and they say, what are these things? And as soon as a human's holding something delicious, they're happy to kind of hand it over.
How did you get to a point where you could actually have one of your humans holding out a hand? I watched some of the video last night. It was just so interesting, holding out his hand in this case with a grape or two on it and actually have the monkey exchange the grapes for the washer.
Yeah, so what we did was to just kind of introduce these tokens. They kind of got used to them. They're not really that interested in the tokens, so they were paying attention to where the grapes were and where the food was. And they kind of just quickly got it. I mean, it took them remarkably little time, about, you know, 5 sessions of 20 trials of trading each, and they kind of got it. What we were able to do, though, is that now that they got that they could trade with one person, the question was, how would they trade when they had a choice of different people? Would they pay attention to things like what kind of food a particular person was selling or the price that he was selling the food at and so on? And so we put the monkeys into a little bit of a market. The way it works is they leave their enclosure where they live with their family. When they're hungry, they come out, they get a little wallet of tokens, and they can go shopping at different experimenters who are standing there. Each person holds out the kind of food he's going to sell, and the price is one token per the amount of food. And the monkeys just get to spend their money as they choose.
And it worked.
One of the first things we saw that was remarkable is that the monkeys tend to pay attention to many of the same rational things that humans do. So just to take one example, they tended to pay attention to the price of a good. So if one experimenter was selling twice as much food for the same amount of tokens, the monkeys would shop at the person who was selling the cheapest good. They also paid attention to sales. So when a particular person switched his price from day one to day two, they responded well to that. They said, oh, man, I can get more grapes for this guy today. I'm going to shop more at the guy who's selling grapes. So all these things that humans do remarkably well in their markets, we saw the monkeys did well, too.
And so eventually what you began to test were some basic human tendencies when it came to sales and transactions and what they could get for one token and then reversing the process. And if they couldn't get as much for their money, what would they do? Walk us through that, Lori, and what did you find out there?
Yeah, so in one study, say, we'd give the monkeys a choice between one experimenter who was selling a chunk of apple and another experimenter who was selling a chunk of grape. Now, for our monkeys, you know, they like apples and grapes about equally, and so what we found there is that they spend about half their tokens on apples and half on grapes. Now what happens when one of these things goes on sale? So today the monkeys come in next day, and then they realize that grapes are on sale. The guy who's selling them is holding two for one token. You know, it's like the coupon where you get two for one. What we found is that the monkeys, as predicted, shopped more for grapes that day. But they didn't just increase shopping for grapes. If you model their behavior using the same kinds of math that you might for human consumers, basically you can't tell the difference between the monkeys' behavior and that of humans. Like pretty much they responded to sales in exactly the same way we'd expect from a human consumer.
Tell us about how you reversed the process, and when you began to take things away, what did you learn there?
Yeah, so one of the next things we were interested in was not just whether the monkeys are as smart as people in markets, but whether they also make some of the mistakes. And one of the mistakes that humans make is that we tend to pay too much attention to losses or going into the red. We want to avoid going into the red at all costs, and sometimes that causes us to make somewhat dumb decisions. And so we're interested in whether the monkeys would do the same. And so here was the setup for that. The monkeys had a choice between two experimenters that would, in the end, give them the same amount of food. They'd both give one piece of apple. But one of the traders started with one piece of apple and then gave that piece, so exactly what the monkey expected. The other one would feel to the monkey like he was going into the red. This guy would start with two pieces of apple, but then when the monkey paid this guy, the monkey would only get one piece of apple. So it looked like the monkey was getting less than he expected.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the monkeys were being rational, they wouldn't care. I mean, both of the guys are giving them one piece, but if the monkeys, like humans, are a little bit too worried about going into the red, they should avoid the guy that looks like he's going to give two but gives one. And that's exactly what we saw. At about the same rates as humans in comparable studies, the monkeys avoided guys that were giving losses, suggesting they show this very human-like irrationality, namely being a little bit loss-averse, and it seems to affect their behavior.
Hmm. And so what's the takeaway from that? What do you walk away with?
Well, I think what we walk away with is that we see a lot more similarities in the economic behavior of monkeys than we might expect, given the fact that they don't use money. What I think that means about humans is that at least some of the tendencies that we use in markets are a lot older than we might expect. We last shared a common ancestor with this monkey species, the capuchin monkey, around 35 million years ago. And we get hints that maybe these biased strategies that we use in markets today might be 35 million years.
And again, the conclusion there is what?
I think the conclusion there is that we have to worry a little bit more about some of these biases than I think economists tend to kind of give credit for. One of the things we know about evolutionarily old biases is they tend to be harder to overcome than we think. You know, take the fact that evolution prepared you to like, sweet, fatty foods, right? Evolution prepared you to kind of feel icky about spiders and so on. All these things are really hard to override. Even with the best intentions, it's better just to not be in an environment where you have sweet, fatty foods if you're trying to go on a diet. My guess is the way we should deal with some of our economic decisions is the same way. It's going to be really hard when people feel like they're going into the red to not behave as though they're avoiding losses. And that, I think, has some interesting policy implications for how we should set up our markets and set up our economies if we want to avoid falling prey to some of these.
Hmm. Again, we're talking with Dr. Lori Santos from Yale about her research with monkeys and what they can teach us about our own fallibilities as human beings. And as you're hearing, maybe we can learn quite a bit here. If you have questions for Dr. Santos, our number here, 816-235-2888, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. What did you find out, Lori, when it came to the tendency, if there was any, for monkeys to actually save money? What did you find out?
Yeah, that was something interesting that we kind of just saw going through these studies. I mean, one thing we wondered is, you know, we've given them this token currency, right? You know, every day they get to come in and they get a wallet of tokens. Like, would they do anything spontaneous with this? Would they try to save them till tomorrow if they didn't like the food that was on offer today? And we didn't see any of that. At no point did the monkeys spontaneously try to save. Pretty much as soon as they got their wallet of tokens, they spent it all right away. You know, what does that mean? Does that mean, you know, well, there's some spots where humans might be better than monkeys? Well, you know, sort of. I mean, many of us are, you know, saving for big projects in the future, our kids' college and so on. But I think it shows us why saving might be tricky for people and why it's one of the things we need to work on as a species. It's not the kind of thing that comes naturally to monkeys, and that might tell us something about the extent to which it will come naturally to us.
So that's the natural inclination, is that these monkeys did not want to save money, and obviously for humans and for our country, that's proven to be a similar kind of situation.
Exactly. I mean, in some ways, our species has it a little better because we have a few mechanisms to save that they don't have. I always joke with my students who work with the monkeys that, you know, our monkeys don't have pockets, right? It's not clear what they can do with their little wallet of tokens if they decided, you know, save for a year and see what happened to their money. You know, we have a lot of these mechanisms, right? We have bank accounts and 401k plans and so on. We haven't yet given the monkeys these kinds of things, you know, some account into which they could put their tokens for later. But my guess is we'd see probably a lot of the same results. My guess is it's going to be tricky for them to forego a good reward they could take now to wait for something better later.
What did you find out, Lori, in terms of larceny? To what extent would monkeys rob each other? Would they rob their human buddies if they had an opportunity to do it?
Yeah, well, we sometimes see bad behaviors when humans are dealing with money. We saw the same kind of thing with the monkeys. They never really robbed each other because typically they only have the tokens when they kind of come in for testing, which means they're kind of by themselves. They've sort of left everyone else in the group. But we did occasionally see cases where they thought they could sort of pilfer from some tokens from us. And you know, that told us a couple things. One is, you know, they get this market and the value of tokens, right? They kind of understand that these things are valuable and the kind of things they could take. But the other is that, you know, you can sometimes see nasty primate behaviors coming out in all kinds of cases, too. So.
I should point out that Dr. Lori Santos will be giving the 10th annual Paul D. Bartlett Senior Lecture. That'll be at 7 p.m. on Thursday at the Linda Hall Library. She'll be talking about the evolution of economic irrationality, insights for monkeys. The seating capacity for this lecture has already been reached, but there's a waiting list that's been established. You can find out more information by going to our website at kcur.org for a chance to perhaps see Dr. Lori Santos out at Yale. So what are you working on now? What's sort of the next frontier when it comes to your research with monkeys?
Well, there's a couple of things that we're working on now. I mean, now we have this lovely market where we can ask economic questions of monkeys. And I think one of the things that we've been up to most recently is trying to see, well, what else can we learn? One thing we're very interested in is this question of where the monkeys might differ from humans, both if there are cases where the monkeys seem to do better than humans do in their own economies, and other cases where they do worse. I mean, we have to see some differences, right? Because, you know, we're a species that's here having this meta conversation about human finances and so on. You know, none of our capuchin monkeys are having similar conversations right now. So where is the spot where we're really different? And one area we've been looking at is the way that we think about price and how it maps onto value. And this is something that humans understand exquisitely, right? We know something about supply and demand. We know that, you know, typically higher priced things tend to be more demanded. They tend to be better valued goods. But sometimes, you know, different marketers can sort of exploit this. In particular, there's sometimes little correlation, particularly for luxury goods, between the price of a good and the quality of it. Sometimes we can fall prey to this. And there's some lovely studies showing if you bring people into the lab and you have them taste different, what are supposed to be different kinds of wines, but are in fact the same kind of wine, people's preferences for those wines will map onto the price. So if I give you a sip of wine and say, this wine's $100, you'll like that wine more than exactly the same wine that I give you a sip and say, oh, this is, you know, only $4, you know, 50 cents. And so it seems like we can be tricked by our own price information. And that means, you know, just by charging us more money, people can get us to like goods more.
Hmm.
And so here was a spot where we thought we might start seeing some differences with the monkeys, a spot where, you know, maybe they might not fall prey to the same bias because they don't understand this rich thing that we do, like about supply and demand and economics and so on. And so far, this is what we're actually seeing in some new work that we've been doing. We introduced the monkeys to new kinds of goods, and they're not as tripped up by the price as we are.
Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Lori Santos about her experiments with monkey and what they can teach us about the American economy. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888, our email address, update@kcur.org. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to the second half of Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's recommendations from the book doctors, you can find it at kcur.org. And be sure to join us on Monday for a discussion on the conflict between presidents and Congress, plus the risks of drone warfare. That's Monday on the program. This hour, we're talking with Dr. Lori Santos. She's a Yale professor who's done some incredible research with monkeys and what that research can tell us about human beings and our own how infallible we can be sometimes and how mistake-prone we can be sometimes when it comes to dealing with money and dealing with the economy. Our number here, 816-235-2888, our email address, update@kcur.org, or you can go to KCUR's Facebook page. Let's go to Scott from Lawrence. Scott, you're on the program. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a quick question for Dr. Santos, and this may be broader than she would be comfortable talking about in terms of the research that she was a part of, but it occurs to me that a suggestion from her research is that evolutionary theory has an awful lot to offer to our understanding of things that we wouldn't think of as evolutionarily. That is that economics often, I think, is perceived in our society as being a sort of a separate field that has nothing to do with evolution. And I wondered what she thought about what this means for us as we think about the kinds of things that can be explained or can be understood better if an evolutionary perspective is applied to them.
That's interesting, Scott. Lori?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I mean, my sense is that some of this work is really teaching us how important taking an evolutionary perspective really is. I mean, we as humans often think that we're this special species, but of course, you know, we got here through some of the same processes as other animals, and so turning to other animals can often give us rich insights. Some of the folks who are doing work on natural behavior in primates are looking at this by studying biological markets. So how can the way that, you know, monkeys actually trade grooming and food tell us something about the way modern economies work? Another group is sort of looking at social decision-making. So how does the fact that monkeys sometimes do nice things for each other, what can that actually tell us about human altruism and human behavior? So I think some of these links are starting to be made, but I think it's, as you said, a really important insight that these evolutionary processes are telling us something about our own species and some of the things our species uniquely does, like participate in economies and so on.
Lori, is there anything to what Scott said about, you know, economics being sort of a topic that's sort of off to the side a little bit? It's maybe more human created that maybe might begin to raise questions about how valid some of these findings might be or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's always this perspective that, you know, economics is its own field. And I think the tricky thing with that is that I think economics has told us a lot about the nature of these biases and the way we make decisions in real markets. But so far, I mean, I think until recently, it's been relatively silent on where those decisions come from in the first place. I think economists sort of assume without saying so that, well, it's, you know, all these market forces sort of drive the way we make decisions, or something about learning maybe allows us to have these strategies, or maybe they're just kind of, you know, plopped there from the heavens, who knows. But I think the good thing about this work is that it's actually questioning, okay, where do some of these strategies come from in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
And if we know where these strategies come from, can that tell us something about how to change them around so people can make better decisions?
Scott, yeah, does that get you there? Yeah.
Yeah, very interesting. Just that idea that I think sometimes there's a presumption in economic theory that there's a kind of a big bang or a black box that we don't need to know anything about and maybe can't.
Yeah.
And I think Dr. Santos's research suggests that maybe we could know something about it, but we have to get at it from another discipline.
Hmm. Scott, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to Hawkeye from Overland Park. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address, update@kcur.org. Hawkeye, go ahead.
Yes, I had a question for you about the role of irrationality in economic behavior, and if irrationality could be somehow traced to our human ancestry, and whether it's to our primeval brain, the kind of reptilian brain, and whether that reptilian brain, our original from our original ancestors. Has anything to do with fear, and whether irrationality is a description of fear, or whether it's something that allows us, to conduct our economic behavior or even everyday life, activity, whether there's any evolutionary connection to that you can see.
Dr. Yeah, Santos, what about fear? Yeah.
I mean, one of the things we're learning about how humans process decisions is that sometimes fear can be more involved than we think. So researchers who use what's called functional imaging techniques, basically imaging the brain while people make economic decisions, they've been able to learn a lot about, which areas of the brain respond to these phenomena of when we go into the red or when we lose money. And it turns out that one part of the brain known as the amygdala responds a lot. It just happens to be the same part of the brain that's involved in tracking threatening, fearful things. It tends to be involved in a lot of situations in which we might sort of assume fear or sort of experience fear. And that, I think, tells us a lot about, the fact that perhaps our reptilian brain or these areas of the brain that process fearful information are involved when we, look at our returns for the month and we see things going into the red, or when we look at the value of our home online and realize it's dropped some. Even though these decisions and these strategies are happening in these human-specific markets, they're tapping into these much older processes. And I think that's part of why we sometimes trip up and make bad decisions, is that we might be using these kinds of older processes. We might be experiencing things like fear and so on, and that might be driving some of the errors that we...
Hawkeye, does that help?
Yes, it does. And maybe you can also follow up on the most recent research on the brain of liberals and conservatives. I don't know if you're aware of that or not.
Well, our monkeys, this is a spot where I can't speak for monkeys here. So
monkeys, okay. Monkeys do not hold any political lines. I got it.
Well, it's actually one of the interesting questions we've been following up on is, what do they think about distribution of resources and distribution of wealth? And one of the guesses we have is that it might vary a lot across species. Different primates vary a lot in terms of how egalitarian they are, how much they tend to share resources and food and reproductive access, and how despotic they are, how much there's kind of one head guy and he controls access to things. And so we might come from a long line of other species that vary a lot in their perceptions of how wealth should be distributed. I won't speculate on what that means for our own species, but it's definitely a topic that primate researchers are very interested in right now.
You know, what struck me about your work, and you talked about this, Lori, when you gave your talk to the TED conference, is sort of the scary implications of what you're finding here. And that is that these tendencies that you're finding with monkeys in terms of how they deal with money are millions of years old, which immediately raises the question, what does that say about, human beings and our ability to eventually overcome our own shortcomings when it comes to dealing with money, dealing with markets, dealing with debt, that kind of thing? And that, to me, struck me as the real rub, the real crux of what you're coming across here.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people hear that message and find it really scary. I actually find it very hopeful, in part because we're a species that deals with our biological limitations all the time, right? I mean, I'm sitting here in New Haven, far away from Kansas City, but we're able to talk because we're a species that can develop technology for the fact that, we're very far away, right? We can deal with our own illnesses. We can deal with our own biological constraints. We can fly, we can see when our eyesight's bad. We do this stuff all the time. I think that when we're dealing with our own cognitive limitations, when we're dealing with limitations in our thinking, we don't think in some ways the same way, in part because we're humbled by those limitations. But my guess is that we can harness the same kinds of species smarts to develop technologies to deal with these kinds of biases. It just means that we have to recognize them and believe that they're there. I mean, somehow it's okay for a human to admit, well, I can't fly to Kansas City tomorrow. I should probably hop on an airplane. Yeah, but it's harder to admit, you know, I can't deal with the news that my house, you know, has dropped in price. That's going to affect me in ways that are going to make me have bad decisions. Maybe I should use some technology to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is to really overcome our evolutionary ancestry, we're going to have to use technologies and very human-specific cultural artifacts to get around our own irrationalities, too.
Well, and yet, as you also point out, just a couple of years ago, the American economy came within an eyelash of total meltdown, despite the fact that our parents and their parents and their parents before them were all telling us lessons like we have to recognize our own limitations and be aware of what we're good at and what we're not so good at. You know, basic stuff got overlooked here, and we almost cratered right off the planet, in a sense.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is the thing that psychology is dealing with today, is that we're very good at dealing with our own biological limitations, right, in terms of our health and so on. We fix that stuff all the time. We're very good at dealing with our own physical limitations. You know, we have technologies for that. It's trickier when we're dealing with our own psychological implications because, you know, it's hard for us to accept the fact that we're not these perfect rational species that we'd like to believe. But there are tons of new approaches out there in terms of policy that allow for just this, that say, you know, sometimes we're going to need a little bit of help. You know, maybe we can nudge our decisions in the right direction. Maybe we can set up environments that make it easier for us to make the right choices. I think these things are all on the horizon, but it does involve admitting that we are not always as rational a species as we'd like to think.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here, our email address, update@kcur.org. Dr. Santos, do you find that people tend to discount your work because, after all, you're dealing with monkeys?
I found just the opposite, actually. When we first started doing this work, I assumed it'd be very hard to get the economists' attention. But in fact, you know, I think people, when they see the monkeys making the same kinds of decisions, when they see them using tokens and using a market that seems very similar, I think the similarities are so striking that people can't help but pay attention. So I've actually been pleasantly surprised by the extent to which folks have listened to this work and seen the implications.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here, our email address, update@kcur.org. Well, just continuing that thought, do you think one of our failures when it comes to the sciences has been not to utilize monkeys more than we have over the years? And do you have questions about the way we've treated monkeys over the years as well?
Yeah, I mean, one of the striking things I think we've learned over the last few decades is that the other primate species are much more similar to us than we would have realized.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this has lots of implications for how we treat other primates and what we do with their habitats.
Do you think we don't want to acknowledge that? Is there something in us that says we don't really want to admit that we're more like monkeys than we really are?
I mean, I think there's, you know, humans like to believe that we're special. There is a Genesis Haldane once wrote, you know, all species are unique, but humans are the uniquest. You know, we really like to believe that we're these special creatures. And I think one of the things that this work in economics is showing us is that, you know, we have some problems and we're dumb, but we're not alone in our dumb strategies. You know, other species seem to make as many errors as we do in similar contexts.
Again, our number 816-235-2888. Dr. Santos speaks at 7 o'clock on Thursday evening. She gives the 10th annual Paul D. Bartlett Senior Lecture, and her title of her lecture will be The Evolution of Economic Irrationality, Insights from Monkeys. We have a tweet here from Glenn who asks, has Dr. Santos done any work with monkeys trading objects with each other for services rendered? And I guess you've talked a little bit about that, but he also says he's curious if you've done any work with WRT monkeys. That make any sense to you?
I'm not sure. WRT monkeys, maybe it's an acronym that I'm missing. But one of the things that came out in the press when we originally did the work was that, you know, maybe the monkeys would set up their own prostitution ring, and, you know, maybe they'd sort of do this sort of services rendered thing. So far, we haven't really seen much in the way of that. And the reason is that an interesting thing is that the monkeys don't spontaneously start trading the tokens with each other. They use this token economy with us. but they don't tend to use it with each other to exchange, you know, goods and services. I think the reason is that this species already has a decent system in place for how they do that. They have a dominance hierarchy, so the alpha male gets access to all the females. The females like the alpha male the best. There's not really any great goods and services for them to exchange because they already have this system. So in cases where, you know, one of the lower-ranking monkeys, if he were to get access to tokens, probably what would happen is he'd be scared to have those tokens around the alpha male because the alpha male would want to take them from him. So The interesting thing is that we don't tend to see the monkeys spontaneously using the tokens with each other, which we think is starting to provide us with some hints about how their market and the way they think about it might be different from our own.
Hey, have you thought about, you know, messing with that hierarchy and doing experiments that begins to, you know, alter their natural cultural state and see what comes of that?
There've been some old work actually doing something just like that. And some of the very old studies many decades ago would try to do things like teaching the lowest ranking male how to operate a popcorn dispenser, say, so he could provide, you know, lots of food and no one else knew how to do it. And what you often find is that when it comes to dispensing the popcorn, the higher-ranking guys will let the monkey do that. But for everything else, access to females, good places to sit, whatever, that guy's still at the bottom of the hierarchy. And so my guess is their hierarchy norms and the way they think of exchanges of goods and services is going to trump whatever experimental manipulations we put in.
Mm-hmm. Tell us again where you're going next with your own research, Lori.
So we're actually looking now to see if there are spots where the monkeys are smarter than people in terms of their own economies. And one of the spots that we're starting to see where the monkeys might be sharper than us is in terms of confusing price and value. So humans can sometimes see objects as more valuable when they're higher priced.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you, chocolates, you know, this chocolate is $100. You'd taste it and think it tastes better than a chocolate I told you was, you know, 50 cents at the grocery store. You can even see these effects if you look neurally. So if you put people in one of these functional imaging machines and look at their very reward areas, just telling them they're tasting something that's more expensive can actually change how much your reward areas fire to different kinds of foods and so on. What we're seeing is that the monkeys aren't falling for this. When we teach them about new foods and tell them different prices, they don't tend to like the more expensive things better. They just go on the taste of the food.
But we do. We oftentimes think that more expensive is better, right?
Exactly. And this seems to be a spot where the monkeys aren't as tripped up.
Yeah.
And so what we're starting to see is that we might be seeing some differences between the kinds of errors we make that are due to our evolution and the kinds of errors we make that are due to our cultural world and what we learn over time from our human-specific experiences. And you know, maybe this will tell us, you know, parts of our biases that might be a little bit more easy to overcome than others.
Bill from Grandview. Bill, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. It's a fascinating conversation. Up to this point, I've really enjoyed it. I have one quick question. When you brought up trade for services, and there was a little chuckle in her voice when she said they were looking for prostitution, but in nature, sex doesn't have a morality clause.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sex is natural, where we take it in the abnormal, and it becomes a weighted way. Is that there won't be a services other than scratching backs, picking lice, grooming effects that might be traded off instead of the other, you know, where the alpha male gets all the female?
Yeah. We haven't seen any services rendered, be they grooming and so on. The reason I chuckle about the prostitution thing is that was one of the first things that came up in the press when we started talking about this work. and so I found it fascinating, not because of my own biases against sex and prostitution, but just that there's this idea that if you teach monkeys about money, the first thing they'll do is set up this prostitution ring. So and so I thought the person who had sent in the tweet was indicating that sort of idea. But yeah, I mean, it'd be neat to look at whether we could force the monkeys to start trading these tokens with each other or kind of induce them to do that and whether they would spontaneously start trading other things like grooming and food and so on.
Well, Dr. Santos, I sure enjoyed having you, and thanks for taking some time. We'll look forward to seeing you in Kansas City next Thursday.
Excellent. Thanks so much for having me on.
All the best, Lori. That's Dr. Lori Santos. She's an associate professor of psychology at Yale. Coming up next, Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list.
Yeah. lantern. You've got your feet kicked up on the dashboard and the sun is kissing your skin. This is where I want to be. You've got me feeling good.
Oh, Brian McTavish is here. Good song, man. The Low Cash Cowboys.
Singing You Got Me.
I like that song. Yeah, I liked it a lot.
Yeah, as opposed to You Really Got Me by the Kinks. You know, it's funny how these pinned against the mat of love themes never really go away. Low Cash Cowboys headlining the Country Music Bill, 8 o'clock today.
Yeah, yeah.
Beaumont Club in Westport. Latest single. That's a great tune.
That's a great tune.
They're on a globe-hopping tour.
They sound like they'd be fun, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's their whole thing. They're all about the fun. They're going to be fun in Alaska, Germany, Switzerland.
Wow.
Yeah, but, you know, the thing is, even though they're all around the globe, they're just, you know, really reliably centered on that country rock thing.
I like that first line, a million miles an hour down a 40-mile highway.
A few years ago, they were happy to, very happy to be selling 50 or 60,000 copies of their homemade CD. That's quite an accomplishment. And then Budweiser threw them some promotional love, and pretty soon they were sharing bills with Charlie Daniels and ZZ Top and doing halftime shows for NBA games. They're hard driving. They're no let up. I get a kick out of this quote from their official bio. The Low Cash Cowboys like to say, we're like stage Marines. We walk out, we take one look at the audience, and attack.
Wow.
And they're actually doing
they're
doing some U.S. military gigs in Germany here pretty soon as part of their tour. So that should go over pretty well. They're out of control and they're crazy, and they're the Low Cash Cowboys. Check them out.
Yeah.
8
p.m. Friday at the Beaumont Club.
Tonight at the Beaumont.
Over in Westport. Okay. Puppet are you, buddy? I know you're a puppet, too. I like that song.
Well, you know, I like that. That's a great old soul classic.
But we're not talking really music. You were talking real puppets.
Well,
real puppets.
What is a real puppet? Now, there's a conundrum.
There you go.
What we have here, we have a show called Stuffed and Unstrung. Mm. And it's going to be here courtesy of the Henson Alternative Puppet Theater.
Mm.
8 o'clock Saturday, Yardley Hall, Carlson Center, John C. Community College. Now, when I say Henson, you think Muppets, right?
Yes, I do.
Okay, rightly so.
Sesame Street and the whole thing.
Absolutely. Now, these are uncensored Muppets, so to speak.
You could think
of it as naughty Muppets because it's Brian Henson, the son of Jim Henson, who created the Muppets, a genius who he's been gone since 1990 from that killer strain of Streptococcus.
I did not know that.
Yeah, but his son Brian has carried on admirably. He actually voices Kermit the Frog too. He's done that for all these years, just like his dad.
But this is R-rated puppetry.
This is
for adults.
Rated puppetry for adults. I'm told poop jokes will be involved. So you think about this.
Of course.
Aren't poop jokes really just
puppets and poop jokes,
kids?
Sure.
I mean, it's like, you know, would you take your kid to see an R-rated movie? You might not. Anyway, Stuffed and Unstrung lays it on the line, although I don't think strings are involved. Here's the deal. You get on a big screen, you see the traditional puppet show because the camera is showing just the puppets. But if you will,
in the theater, you're
in the theater,
people see that,
right? But if you look at the stage, you see Henson and five or six other cohorts doing all the behind the scenes stuff. So you see two shows in one, actually.
Wow.
And what's interesting is this Stuffed and Unstrung alternative adult puppet theater, if you will, evolved from a very small class or workshop where Henson was just trying to see what he could try, and it's turned into something bigger than that. He says, the next thing we knew, we were no longer in a class, but world traveling. He calls it very, very rewarding, but I guess poop jokes are just pretty much rewarding in general.
That's 8 p.m. Saturday at Johnson County Community College.
You had a temper.
Now we're talking literary cannon fodder, speedy, sketch-based comedy interpretations of great books from Western civilization. My goodness. Of course, this is in Lawrence.
Of course
Where
it's in Lawrence.
Where else would it be? Wouldn't be in Kansas. It's a Lawrence thing.
And, you know, we picked Kate Bush, and she's singing Wuthering Heights, one of the great classics of literature. And the two Lawrence actors, Kerry Jackson and Jerry Mitchell, who will be doing that speedy sketch-based comedy based on great works of Western civilization, they may well tackle Wuthering Heights.
Very ambitious to me.
It is. It is. I think it's educational-based, maybe 2% and 98%. It's for adults. There are some naughty bits, you know.
Okay.
It's at 8 o'clock today and Saturday at the Lawrence Arts Center in 940 New Hampshire, Lawrence, for all you address freaks out there. A canon is defined as any comprehensive list of books within a field. Cannon fodder?
Uh-huh.
Foot soldiers who are sacrificed on the field of battle. Put them together and you get a comedy explosion, at least 2,000 years of history, at least 100 books, and these two actors being totally irreverent with the classics. Oedipus, the Bible, for goodness sake, in under a minute. They do each of these classics in under a minute. Dante's Inferno, Machiavelli's The Prince, Don Quixote, Moby Dick, Romeo and Juliet. So,
you know, I'm proud of you for making a selection like this. It shows that you're extending yourself a little. You're stretching even at this point in your life, and that's good.
I thank you for that.
I appreciate that.
I think that's a sincere salute from the host of the show. I thank you, Steve.
That's 8 p.m. Friday and Saturday over at the Lawrence Arts Center, right?
Yes, sir.
I've been reading about this one. This is Romeo and Juliet and the KC Ballet, right?
Yes, Kansas City Ballet production of Romeo and Juliet. We just mentioned Romeo and Juliet. It'll be crazy silly at the Literary Cannon Fodder event in Lawrence, but it'll be straight up tragedy. 7:30 today and Saturday and 2 on Sunday. It's the opening weekend of the ballet's production of Romeo and Juliet with music by, I can never say this guy's name, it's awful. You say it for me, host. Prokofiev.
Yes.
I got it. It's at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. It's Shakespeare's classic love story.
I hear good things about this.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, here's the deal. They're using their feet a lot more in this production than perhaps in other versions that we've seen on screen or on stage. It is ballet, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really the story. You've got three things going on here: youthful passion, family conflict, and, of course, tragic consequences. These two young lovers, I don't want to give away the ending. They don't make it. And why don't they make it?
I think you just did.
You can say they're mixed up crazy kids, maybe, but the real crazy people are the intolerant, prejudiced, feud-happy grown-ups who surround Romeo and Juliet and drive these kids over the brink. I mean, if two people want to be together, why can't two people be together?
That's a good point.
And I think it's true in so many cases.
That's 7:30 Friday and Saturday and 2 p.m. on Sunday, right?
Yes.
And all of Brian's picks, as always, are on our website, kcur.org. And it's the Mardi Gras KC style.
It comes once a year, whether you're ready or not.
Here it comes.
It's the fourth
annual. I'm not ready.
Well, that's a little Jelly Roll Morton doing a little KC stomp,
like
Mardi
that.
Gras style. Yeah.
I like that.
Now, there's all sorts of Mardi Gras stuff going on all over town this week and then, of course, into next week. But I think probably ground zero for this in Kansas City might well be the fourth annual Mardi Gras Festival at KC Live. You know, there'll be booze, I assume, beads, I assume.
There will be.
And lots of beats. There'll be a DJ hitting the stage around 9 o'clock that Saturday at the outdoor KC Live stage. 10 or 11 participating watering holes will let you drink all you want from 8 until 11 on Saturday. If you want to drink some Sprite or 7-Up, that's fine. Stronger liquor also available. What would you do to get free beads?
Free beads?
Yeah, what would you do? I would lift my shirt for beads.
Would you?
I don't think I'd get arrested. I mean, I'm a male of the species. I should take advantage of the double standard. I get a lot of funny looks, but I'm not going to be carted off, am I?
No. That's this weekend. Yeah. That sounds like fun.
Yeah. So you're telling me, come on, Steve.
No, I'm not going to lift my shirt for beads. No.
Would you get me to do it?
Yes.
Would you give me free beans?
You would do it, yes. That's
all
what
right.
I like about you. That's why we work out well together here. You would do it, I wouldn't.
I think I managed to significantly compromise your ethical standards.
That's Brian McTavish, buddy. Thanks as always, man. Nice job.
Happy Mardi Gras. Happy weekend. See you next time.
Same to you, Brian. Again, you'll find his complete weekend to-do list as well as previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Monday on the program, the historian of the U.S. Senate, plus former diplomat and retired colonel, Ann Wright. We had help this week from KCUR's Kim Noble, Kathleen Pointer, Danny Alexander, and Maria Carter. Our show is produced by Stephen Steigman. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.